Our final speaker is Sandra Levinson. Sandy is the founder and executive director of the Center for Cuban Studies in New York City and director of the center's Cuban Art Space. She's traveled to Cuba more than 300 times, often as a consultant to major news organizations. Sandra just returned from Cuba last week. Is that correct?
Yes.
She can share with us what people in Cuba think of the developments, what changes she's observed, if any, and what effects she thinks the shift in policy could have socially and culturally here and in Cuba.
Thank you. I think there are so many people in this room who have shared experiences with me and with others in Cuba. All of you have been, probably have the same concerns I do about what normalization means or what it could mean in Cuba. But I think, it's not a moment of euphoria, that's for sure, because we're well aware of the traps that can be set by the United States, even with our friends. Forget somebody who's been an official enemy for 55 years. We set traps for our friends, cultural traps that are very tough to overcome. And I think that one of the things that we really have to recognize about Cuba now is that when we talk about normalization of relations, we're talking, the question, what does normalization mean? It means something very different today than it would have meant 50 years ago, 40 years ago, even 30 years ago, if we had attempted to normalize relations with Cuba during that time. But this is Cuba 55 years later. And Cuba is a very, very different society from the one that we broke relations with. We broke relations with a baby, a little socialist baby. And we're trying to restore relations with an adult. And all of you who have spent time in Cuba know how complicated that adulthood has been for the Cubans. And it applies to everybody. You know, it applies to the elderly, it applies to those who, the elderly who fought in the revolution, who fought next to Fidel, who fought in their hometowns, it applies to their children, their grandchildren, all of the families that have been broken up by this many, many years of blockade. It applies to all of the separations, all of the people that you and I know whose children and grandchildren have left Cuba for the United States or for other countries, but mostly to the United States. Some of my oldest friends have had to deal very late in life with the fact that their children and their grandchildren have suddenly picked up and left the country because our blockade has been so harsh and so unrelenting that it has made it difficult for individual Cubans to develop as much as the country has developed. What is incredible to all of us who know Cuba is how wise the average Cuban is, how much the average Cuban knows, not only about what he or she has learned in school, right? But about the world, about the relationship with the United States, about it, what it means to be a Cuban today. If any of you have ever had a long conversation with any Cuban, you know what I mean. I went to Cuba for the first time in 1969. And as someone commented, I've been back often. just since November, I've been back and forth 6 times. You know, it's a little overwhelming sometimes. Sometimes my cats forget who I am. But the fact is that what the Cubans, when you talk to people about why they want to go back to Cuba, and almost everyone does, I'm not talking just about the visitors, but also the people who have come from Cuba. But when I talk to the visitors, people like ourselves and people not like ourselves, people who, you know, Cuba for them is just, or they thought it was just a notch in their tourist belt. You know, they went, they saw, they conquered, they left. And suddenly they realize they want to go back. Well, you know, when I went in 69 and 70 and 71, I mean, I knew very well why I wanted to go back. You know, this was a country that socially and culturally spoke to me in a way that no other country ever had. You know, I walked into a country, I felt, oh my God, there's a whole country of people like me. What do you think about that? They work really hard, they play very hard, and they sleep very little. And they're building a whole new country. And it was very exciting because it was a little bit like being in your first year of college. You know, you sat around very late at night discussing things, you know, discussing politics, discussing religion, discussing sex. It went on for hours and hours, and everybody had so much to say. You know, you would think that that gets boring after a while. Well, guess what? It doesn't. You know, when I talk to people who go to Cuba now, and, you know, I try to figure out because Cuba has been through so many difficulties and so many hardships, and especially in the 90s with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the fact is that Cubans didn't have enough to eat. And the jokes about grapefruit steaks referred to real eating habits. They weren't just jokes. And yet, they survived. But it was difficult. And Cuba wasn't the beautiful socialist country we thought it was going to be. And so when people would come back, I would question them and say, but why did you like it so much? You know, what is it that attracts you so much? Why do you want to keep going back, even though you've been there and you've been there once or twice? Why is this your fifth trip to Cuba? Because there are so many difficulties. And it always came down to the people. It always came down to the fact of what people's expectations were. That basically people were expecting a third world country or maybe a developing country. I don't think even some of the most sophisticated of us as travelers expected to find in Cuba a whole country of people, first of all, who were still talking to you face to face. I mean, they weren't walking down the street with a cell phone and looking like this. So face-to-face communication, people usually associate with third world countries with not very much education, not very much employment, people sitting around on their front stoops and talking to one another. Well, guess what? The Cubans do that. Even though they're working, even though they're very well educated, even though they know a lot about everything, they still want to talk to you about everything. And they still want to argue about everything. So it's been interesting to me to see what it is about the culture that people like and find invigorating about Cuba. And what scares me about the so-called normalization is the possible destruction of that kind of culture. And I think that, you know, in a way, it's our responsibility to help prevent that. Because the Cuban, you know, money talks. You know we're very powerful. You know people in Cuba like our music. They like our art. They want to know more about everything we do. They like our technology. They wish they all had it. They wish everyone was on the internet. They wish everyone had a cell phone. And the fact that we find it wonderful that everyone doesn't have a cell phone doesn't mean that they don't want it. And we can't put our preferences onto their likes and dislikes. What we can help do, though, I think, and what we have to try and do is to show them that there are people like us, you know, who believe something different, perhaps, than the majority of people in the United States, who, yes, take advantage of the technology, take advantage of the advantages we have, but still think that other things are perhaps more important. And, you know, I don't have to talk about what those things are. I can see the government of Cuba itself, you know, getting into business. You know, I can see the government of Cuba and clever people in the government proposing all kinds of cooperatives that interrupt that direct line to the private sector or to the private person. I mean, one thing is running a paladar and bringing a lot of extra spices and extra dishes and lamps and things that make your paladar look beautiful and make lots of people come and eat your good food. That's okay. It's on a small scale. But right now, for example, I mean, Cuba doesn't allow people with a paladar to have a chain of paladars across the country. They don't allow a person opening a barbershop to have a chain of barbershops across the country. In other words, they're very much aware of the difference between giving people a chance to become something in their own sphere and in their own community and becoming a major capitalist. And, you know, that's an entire long discussion, and it goes into not only the law, but also the history that Michael spoke about. I agree with Joan 100%. There is no way the Cubans are ever going to give up Assata Shakur or anyone else who's a political prisoner. And I mean, the very fact that the United States would even suggest that, or some Christie or idiot Menendez, maybe we could do a swap. Bring Assata back as a heroine and send Menendez back to a Cuba he doesn't know. But, you know, the fact is that Cuba has stuck to its principles through the worst of times. Why should we think that Cuba won't stick through to its principles through a better time? I hope that we can help her do that. And I salute you, Cubans. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sandy.
I just wanted to comment on the so-called private sector, because one of the major areas in which there has been a so-called private sector is in the cultural area, and particularly with visual artists. And, you know, they provide a kind of good example. They were the first ones to be taxed for somebody to work on a tax structure, because they sold their art for hard currency. And so the tax code, which is far from complete and in no way analyzable by people like you and me yet, maybe by Michael soon, but the very fact that artists and other people who were making money in hard currency were the first ones to be taxed. In other words, the Cubans are not interested in taxing their average citizen, but only those who are going out into a private world and charging in hard currency and making money in hard currency, and they are expected to pay taxes. It's funny sometimes to see people protest against paying taxes and my arguing with them and saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, you got all this education free, you got all your art materials free, and now you're complaining because you have to pay taxes? Come on, if you were living in the United States, you would have been paying taxes all of the time, and you wouldn't have gotten that free art education. It would have cost you about $50,000 a year. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that sometimes, you know, when you have been taken care of so well, by the state, you are completely unaware of what the real world looks like outside, which is why I think we have a little bit of a responsibility there. But I see a couple of areas that might be really interesting, considering what Michael talked about as the main areas in which normalization might take place, and that is in terms of travel and in terms of telecommunications. That I think one of the things that's happened in all these years is that Cuba has trained thousands of its young people to be guides for all of us, you know, all of us tourists. And they have trained these young Cubans to know their own countries in a very special way. I mean, most of the Cubans that I've worked with are Cubans who come from families where they never even traveled around Cuba. They didn't know anything outside of the town where they grew up. And now they know like the back of their hands all of Cuba. So I can see a lot of those young people working in a kind of state and private, you know, combination, some kind of cooperative where individual tourists who will eventually start coming will be able to use their services and they will be able to help you and me. In telecommunication, I think, you know, it's funny, ABC did a little story on the fact that the artist Cacho has opened up part of his community project to free Wi-Fi. I know it well because last week I downloaded 646 emails on my phone while I was standing there for a half hour. And there were, you know, maybe 20, mostly young people sitting there with their phones or their computers and taking advantage of the free Wi-Fi. I think that that will grow enormously. And I think that a lot of the people, the so-called private enterprises, will be private enterprises that are done virtually. I mean, the Cubans are so smart. And I just hope that, you know, that intelligence is not used only by us to hire them, you know, the way we do with India or something, but that they, who are so imaginative, will think of their own ways to make money virtually with us, you know, and with one another. I'm in Havana, you're in Santiago, and guess what? We could start this whole thing, you know, and people are already thinking that way, so they're very excited about that. And they're also very aware of the dangers, which I think is important. You know?
Okay.